Okay. No, please go ahead and continue. Thank you.
Hi there, I'm Brendan Calhoun. I'm with UConn Flats National Wildlife Refuge, the acting assistant manager for the next 6 weeks. So I'm here more so just to learn, but I appreciate the invite.
Hi, I'm sorry. I think I missed introductions. My name is Rhonda Pitka. I'm chief of the Village of Beaver, and I sit on the Federal Assistance Board and the UConn River Panel. Thank you.
So if there isn't any other introductions, I'd like to go ahead and go into concerns and comments from the public. Any public comments?
Hey, Mr. Chairman, this is Ben Stevens here. As a member from Stevens Village, I want to thank the folks that have called in that have volunteered to participate to make sure their community's voice is heard. Because what we have found out is that the AC role in game management is critical, and we as rural people haven't been involved very much. And so it's really good to see local folks getting their voice into the discussion. So I want to say Bossy to everybody, and Mr. Chuck Peter, thank you for stepping up to be the acting chair. I think that you would be the appropriate person to have as our chair when that time comes. That's it, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. And congratulations on your AC membership for Stevens Village. So on.
Thanks. Yeah.
Yeah, so from there, I'd like to go to concerns, comments from AC members. Any new members that want to make comments or any concerns, go ahead and do so. Just from there. Thank you. Yeah, this is Walter Peters, Port Yukon here. And I just wanted to mention that we haven't had any AC meeting in a long time. I mean, it's probably been about 2 years. And during that time, we lost a few members that passed away. So I'd like to remember those people. You know, Andrew Furman and Vicky James.
Hi, Walter. This is Amanda Pope for the record. I appreciate you bringing the recognition up for the past board members that were that had left and had passed on. I appreciate you bringing that up. I am excited that this AC is finally up and going, and I look forward to continuing and helping as much as I can.
Hi, this is Rhonda Pitka. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, okay, good. I just wanted to thank you all for calling this meeting, Walter and Amanda. It's been a great concern to me that we haven't had a meeting since, you know, Andrew Furman passed. And, you know, it's that big of a loss in our community. We, you know, it just seems like sometimes you just fall apart and don't quite know how to regroup. And I really appreciate your leadership on this. And I definitely support you as, like, chair and vice chair for, you know, the long term, too. Thank you all.
Thank you, Rondo. So from there, I'd like to go ahead and approve the agenda. The appropriate time. Need a motion?
I'll
check if that motion. Okay, simultaneously. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed? They say aye. Seeing there's none, we'll go ahead and approve the agenda. And we'll start from the top list there with fisheries and wildlife updates from the AGF&G staff. Leon teleconference or online.
Hi,
Wade.
Yeah, this is Dina John with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I'll start with a brief summary of the 2022 Yukon River summer salmon season. As folks know, we went into the season with some pretty low forecasts, and so we started out the year with fisheries closed, and as the runs came in, they never got big enough to where we could open subsistence fishing for salmon, and so fishing for salmon remained closed the whole summer season. The counts that we had for kings last year were the lowest that have ever been counted at pilot. They only counted about 50,000 kings at pilot. And then for the Canadian origin stocks that made it past the border up by Eagle, the Eagle sonar up there only counted about 12,000 kings. And so those are the lowest counts they've ever had at those projects for kings. The Eagle count was way, way lower than the escapement goal of at least 42,000 fish or 42,500 fish. And for summer chum salmon, pilot station sonar, it was the fourth lowest count that they'd ever seen for summer chum salmon. 2021 was lower, and so the run last year was just a little bit bigger than those really low crash runs back in 2000 and 2001. The escapement numbers that we saw at other projects that were operating last year were also very low. For instance, summer chum into Anvik, they only saw about 45,000 summer chum, and their median is usually around 455,000 summer chum, so about one-tenth of their kind of average counts. They also didn't see a lot of kings or summer chum that made it up to the projects up on the Tina and the Salta. So just overall, the summer season runs last year were really low. Fishing was closed except for non-salmon gear and selective gear where folks could retain pink salmon or sockeye salmon or non-salmon species. We don't have our forecasts out for 2023 yet. Those are going to get worked on and finalized and approved at the Joint Technical Committee of the Yukon River Panel. And so once we've got those forecasts, we're going to be putting out, they're starting to discuss our management strategies. We'll be discussing those with Holly Carroll with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We'll be able to discuss those at Yukon River Panel and at YIRDFA preseason, if there's a YIRDFA preseason meeting or teleconferences. And then, as usual, we'll be putting out an Outlook flyer later on in the spring, usually around April or May. We'll mail out another Outlook flyer like we did last year. Folks may have noticed in the Outlook flyer that we did include a chart that showed harvest of non-salmon species. And so in 2021, the harvest of non-salmon species was pretty low. There wasn't a lot of gear in the water. So folks missed out on a lot of opportunity to get non-salmon. The non-salmon harvest last year for 2022, which will be an updated chart for the flyer coming out, did show that people did harvest more non-salmon last year in 2022, particularly more than in 2021. And so that kind of shows that maybe folks are switching their effort more to non-salmon species. The harvest amounts were still below average, and so they weren't kind of, people are shifting, but I think just not having as much gear in the water has reduced the amount of harvest and effort that's going towards non-salmon, although folks may definitely notice, the area and the harvest and effort for non-salmon in particular communities or by particular families may have increased quite a bit in the face of these really, really low salmon runs. So that's about what I've got for the 2022 season. We did start off an ichthyophauna sampling project, so folks have probably heard a lot about that. I know Holly, Carol, and her Fish and Wildlife Service team have been reaching out to folks in Fort Yukon to discuss sampling efforts there starting next season. In 2022, there was ichthyophauna samples collected from Pilot Station sonar, the Rapids Rampart location, and up at the Eagle sonar. And so those counts did show some pretty high levels of fish that had ichthyophonas, both in terms of the number of fish infected, and then with the new technologies and methods that they've got now, they've also got estimates of the severity. And so, for instance, down at Pilot Station Sonar, they collected samples from 202 kings, and of those fish, 48% were infected. And of those 48% fish that were infected, 9% had a low infection level, 58 had a medium infection level, and 33 had a high infection level. So it's kind of looking at the amount of infections in the tissue that they collected. And then up at Rapids, they got another 200 samples. 53% of the fish had ichthyophonas, and of the fish with ichthyophonas, 57% of them had a high level of infection. And then up at Eagle, they were only able to collect 50 of the project samples. The collection of samples was stopped partway through the season, so they only got 50 up through kind of the earlier part of the run. Of those 50 fish at Eagle, 78% were infected, and of the infected fish, 43% had a high infection rate. And so this is just kind of helping the folks that are looking at this to try to understand what's happening to these fish as they go upriver. And so fish are maybe changing in their infection status as they go, with having having less severe infections lower river, and those infections perhaps getting more severe as the fish get upriver. We still think that fish are experiencing mortality somewhere between rapids and the border. So we might expect to see fish perhaps with high severity infections at Fort Yukon, and then those fish are maybe dying. And so that might be where they didn't see a higher percentage of severely infected fish at Eagle, because those fish may have died before they got to Eagle. But there've been a lot of presentations. There was a good presentation on the Ichthyophonus project at the Board of Fish meeting. Zach Lillard gave some handouts and a presentation at the Eagle AC meeting that took place earlier, just earlier this week. And so if folks in Fort Yukon want to know about this project, please reach out to me. We can see what other kind of materials or presentations or information we can get out about this project. And I know folks in Fort Yukon will probably be talking to Holly Carroll and Fish and Wildlife Service and Keith Ivey as we get closer towards operating in season. And so that's about all I've got for summer 2022. Shane can maybe, he can go ahead and give the fall season update. And then I've also got a brief summary of the actions that were taken on the proposals at the Board of Fish meeting from January 14th to 18th. So with that, I guess I'll take questions about summer season first before we move on to anything else. So yeah, Levine, if you've got any questions about any of the management actions we took last year.
I had the one on the icky opponent. This is Walter at the ick on the fish. I was just curious about the spawning age. Are the spawning eggs also infected with this disease?
I don't think so. I think it's mostly that the ichthyophonus gets into the muscle tissue, and it gets into like the heart tissue in particular, and so That's where we see like the pus pockets and stuff as the body trying to fight off that infection. Ichthyophonus isn't transmitted like from parents to their offspring. The way that fish acquire ich seems to most likely be from eating infected prey in the ocean. So they're most likely eating an infected species out in the ocean. So I can't say 100% sure, but I don't think the eggs are infected and the offspring aren't infected with ich once they hatch.
Okay, thank you.
This is Joe Matese, and you mentioned sampling that was done at the Rapids and at Eagle, and I'm curious about the Porcupine River population. Was there any sampling done in that population, maybe in Mole Crow?
No, there will be a lot of discussions at the JTC and the panel meetings about the possibility of expanding Ichthyophonus further upriver and possibly up into Canada. The project definitely has some drawbacks. The fish that get sampled for Ichthyophonus do have to be killed. There's no non-lethal way to sample the fish, which is why when folks are talking to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service about sampling in Fort Yukon, there's also going to be plans to get any of the sampled fish distributed to locals. There's a lot of considerations that have to go into doing that work and whether or not folks want to sacrifice those fish in order to collect those samples.
Yeah, hey, this is Mike in Fort Yukon. I just want to follow up on a little commenting about the Ichthyophornis. The Fish and Wildlife, I think it was Kyle, with the feds that he was going to come up there and give a presentation. It was supposed to be sometime this winter, but then it got put off until April. So he's going to be coming up sometime around then to let you guys give you guys an update of what's going on. And he's going to be working with the tribe, I guess, and then we're going to be helping out on that part.
Do you know if it was Keith, maybe? Was it Keith, Aaron, Ivy?
Yeah, that's him. It's Keith,
yeah.
Aaron, Ivy.
Yeah, he's super... super motivated young man. He's working, I think, on a master's project that's also involving Ichthyophonus, and so it's really great to see him being involved in this work and seeing what he can get, what kind of project he can get going out of it.
Yeah, I got a question too about Dick. Are they actually getting sick in the ocean and then coming up the Yukon, or, you know, after they hit the Yukon, or, I don't know, I heard a couple of different things that they seem like they're okay, but once they hit the river, the Yukon, they're getting sick.
Yeah, so there is some work. So out in the Bering Sea, there's a juvenile Bering Sea trawl survey, and I think they're going to start sampling fish for Ichthyophonus during that trawl survey to see if fish have acquired an infection when they're maybe like a year old, because those are the fish that get caught in that trawl survey. But what really happens is that fish are out in the ocean, they eat infected prey at some point in the ocean, and then they come into the river to start to migrate. And so some of those fish may be infected and just not have it get kind of blown up into a full-blown disease. But as fish are traveling upriver, they're experiencing a ton of physiological stresses, like their bodies are breaking down, they're not eating, they're swimming, you know, 1,000 miles. They're potentially going through high water or hot water or a lot of other stresses as fish are migrating. And so an infection that they may be able to fight off and keep at a low level in the ocean is potentially able to kind of spread and become more severe as the fish are migrating upriver and experiencing all those other additional stresses. And so kind of what we think is that these fish that are going the longest, furthest distance, like up to Canada, they maybe just don't have enough gas in their tank to keep fighting that off. And to make it all the way to where they need to go. Any other questions about summer season stuff? If not, I can turn it over to Shane. He can give a brief fall season update. And I'll also mention that our summer season update, our season summary was published as an advisory announcement back in November. And so if folks aren't subscribed to advisory announcements, that's a great way to get all of our in-season weekly updates and also our post-season summaries whenever they do get published later in the fall and in the winter.
Yeah, hey, this is Mike again, 40 time. I got another question. Kind of doing with the water temperature, how much is it expected to warm again this year, or what's the average temperature about, and how much has it increased?
I'm certainly not a water temperature expert. We do collect water temperatures at a few of our sampling locations. There might also be other sampling efforts that are taking place in communities, and so I don't have access to that information as readily. It's hard to say what the temperatures are going to look like this summer. I think it's just going to depend on how our weather shapes up, if we have another, you know, kind of hot year or a smoky year, or if we have a rainy year. Yeah, I don't know what I don't really know what the long-term forecast is, for the season coming up.
Yeah, also too, yeah, with that, it seems like our water mark is fluctuating quite a bit too. I know these last few years it's really been pretty above average, you know, the water depth,
yeah,
low and high water.
Once we get into in-season, it's really great to listen to the YIRGPA teleconferences in-season, because even though it takes a long time for the fish to get up to Canada, we'll usually get reports from folks in Canada saying what their snowpack looked like for the past year and what their water levels are up at the headwaters. And so they can kind of give us a little heads up, like, hey, just letting you know we got a ton of snow and we're going to send you a ton of water. We usually can kind of get that information from the Canadians and folks further upriver during those weekly calls.
Is he ready?
Okay, thank you.
Do you have your truck in English?
No. All right. If nothing else for summer season, are folks ready to turn it over to Shane?
It was just air that was right on. I don't know. I have no idea.
Okay, Shane, how about you? But if there's any calls, can you put your phone on mute? You're not talking, can you please put your phone on mute? It's a little noise. Thank you.
This is the Chair. This is Shane Ransbury. I can give the fall season report. So for this year, the fall chum and coho runs on the Yukon River were low again, as you're aware. For the third year in a row, the fall chum run came in below the drainage-wide escapement goal of 300,000-600,000 fall chum salmon, even with all fishing closed. This fall chum run was the third lowest on record, with 236,000 fish compared to a historical run size of 1 million fish. Coho, meanwhile, was the second lowest on record, with 100,000 fish compared to a historical run size of 234,000 fish. We are done with our escapement surveys, and so far, and no escapement goals were met. Similarly, the treaty objective for fall chum returning to Canada was not met. But we did see it, you know, compared to last year, which was the worst, we did a little bit better than last year, basically, for fall chum and coho. This season, subsistence fishing was only open for non-salmon and pink, sockeye, and coho salmon during the fall season. Due to the restrictions in place, subsistence harvest was near record low like last year. Manned fish wheels, dip nets, and rod and reel were allowed in certain areas, but release of all chum and chinook caught was required, and non-salmon gear was open. And then for research, we had three additional projects this season. We collected samples from fall chum salmon to analyze stress hormones. We restarted a historical sonar project on the Sheemjeck River downstream of an important fall chum spawning area. And we deployed radio tags and about 350 coho salmon to track their migration. And I haven't seen the results for that yet, but we should get it fairly soon. I just brought back the last of, like, one of the transceivers from Delta Junction this week. And so I think they've just been working that data for a bit here. And then we also have an ADF&G marine salmon research team that's continuously salmon out in the Bering Sea and Gulf of Alaska, similar to what they've been for summer season. So that's my fall season update. It's pretty short, but yeah, it was a slow year. So I'll open up to any questions. Anyone has any questions for fall season?
Yeah, Yeah, Shane, this is Walter from Fort Yukon. I had a question on data, like, you know, data from the past and the fall some, you know, and, you know, the data from the past years. I was just wondering, is this something that trends with the fall some? Like, you know, because, like, with other animals, you know, they trend go real low, the population drops off, and then it builds back up. Is this something that happens with fall some?
Well, so this is the lowest that we have on record for the fall chum, or, well, not this past year, but this recent decline over the last 3 years. But we had the most recent drop before then was in the early 2000s, and that was quite bad as well. But I guess the ray of hope there is that the fish that came back from some of those years, they had really good survival, and you basically saw much higher returns than we would have expected. I think the low years on the top of my head were like 2000 to 2002, and then by like 2004 or 5, you're starting to see really good runs again. So we do see drops in population for fall chum periodically, and they do usually rebound pretty strong. And then the other one that I can think of before that was, it was like late 80s, early 90s. There was a really cold winter, and it basically, killed a bunch of the eggs while they were still in the beds. And so that led to like a pretty sharp decrease, for, essentially just 1 year. And then they rebounded pretty quick after that. So we do have other times when we've seen fall chum populations drop, and they've rebounded.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? And if there's no more questions, I guess we can turn it back over to Dina, who has an update from Board of Fish.
Hi, yeah, thanks, Shane. Yeah, so we just recently had our AYK Board of Fisheries meeting in Anchorage. It was January 14th through the 18th. Our team was involved in 10 or so of the proposals, and so I can just run through them really quickly. The first couple were proposals 63 and 64, and those both failed, and they had to do with Chattanooga Harvest Area Pike Fishery. Proposal 65 passed, and that has to do with sport fishing in the Tanana River. And so that proposal that passed says that if a salmon is removed from the water, it must be kept and counted towards bag and possession limits. So if folks are doing catch and release, they have to make sure that that fish doesn't leave the water if they're going to release it alive. Proposal 79 is the next one that we helped out with. That was proposed by the Koyukuk River AC, and it passed, and it extended the area where you can hook and line with subsistence from the Nulato River up to and including the Koyukuk River, and I'll talk more about that in a little bit. Proposal 80 was withdrawn by the proposer, and that would have put in place king salmon permits in the middle and upper Yukon. Proposal 81 failed. That was a proposal to have a permit system allowing a harvest of 24 inches smaller kings. Proposal 82, the board took no action on at the January meeting, but is going to be taking it up at the March meeting. And proposal 82 has to do with sinking of gillnets. And so right now folks in the Yukon can sink their gillnets, and this proposal is trying to address that issue in terms of making nets visible either by having nets not sunk or by having more floats. There's some RCs in place. Shane can talk more about it, and it's going to be discussed more at the board in March. Proposal 83 passed, and it has to do with mesh size in the personal use salmon fall fishery or fall season in the personal use fishery near Tanana. Proposal 84 passed as amended. This was our big subsistence gear rewrite. And so I mentioned hook and line. Prior to this board cycle, you could only use hook and line for subsistence from the coast up to the Nulato River. An RC was passed by Olivia from Nenana. She put in an RC to extend hook and line gear for subsistence up through the rest of Districts 4 and Districts 5. And so that did pass. So now hook and line is an allowable subsistence gear all round. It used to just be under the ice or if you were in federal waters, and so this helps to align regulations between state and federal waters. We do have a regulation in place on the books already that says that if it's a time of conservation, we can close and open seasons with hook and line and require that species of conservation be released from hook and line gear. So that's what we did last season down in, up to the Mulatto River. Folks could fish with hook and line, but they had to release kings and chum alive, but they could use that gear for non-salmon species. Some other changes to gear are that during times of conservation by emergency order, Christy and I can require the release of any salmon species. Our previous regulations didn't include coho at all. So if we're having conservation concerns, we can open fishing with dip nets, fish wheels, beach seines, and hook and line gear and require that, for instance, king salmon be released alive. Also, during times of conservation, we can restrict how gill nets are operated. We can restrict them by length, distance from shore by mesh size, and can also require that they be operated as a set net. Folks up in Upper Yukon already only use set net gear, but this was a concern down in Lower Yukon where folks could have potentially drift gill netted with their 4-inch or smaller mesh. So during times of conservation, we can specify a mesh size of either 4-inch or smaller, which we would do for non-salmon species, 4.75 inch or smaller, which we would do for pink salmon just in districts 1 and 2, 6 inch or smaller, where if we've got a concern for kings and we're trying to allow the harvest of chum, we can restrict to that mesh size. And then if there's ever a time of conservation where we're trying to conserve chum but allow the harvest of kings, we could also restrict mesh size to exactly 7.5. We removed all the mentions in regulation of 8-inch mesh, and so just helped to standardize all of our wording to say that 7.5 is the maximum mesh size that can be used in the Yukon River. A couple other little changes are adding eel sticks to subsistence gear types, and so that's also just mostly affects fishermen down up to districts 4. Subsistence fishermen may also operate more than one subsistence gear type at a time, and fishermen can operate gear closer than 200 feet to other gear except for some exceptions around set gill nets and fish wheels. So, for instance, if you've got a fish wheel, you can use hook and line right next to your fish wheel, and so you can use two gear types at the same time. It also means that if you've got your fish wheel operating, your kids can use hook and line right next to your fish wheel. They don't need to be 200 feet away, and so those changes are also in place now. I already mentioned the hook and line change that went into place. There are still some exceptions to hook and line. If you're going to fish in the Dawl River, which is down near the highway, you would still need a sport fish license. And there's some closed waters near the highway corridors where fishing is closed. And also, if you have a permit up in District 5, the permits are going to be updated. So if you're getting salmon with hook and line, you'll need to report that on your permit. The fishing mesh size in Beaver in Birch Creeks, the maximum mesh size for those areas was increased to 4-inch or smaller mesh. Those streams were previously limited to either 3 or 3.5 inch in those areas. So now if you are in Fort Yukon and you have a 4-inch net and you go to Beaver or Birch Creek, you can use that same 4-inch net. So there were a lot of changes that were in that proposal. We'll be sending out advisory announcements detailing all the changes, and we're also waiting on the final regulatory language that won't be available until later this spring. The other proposals that the board took action on included Proposal 85, which had to do with personal use fishing gear, and that passed, and that's kind of some similar regulations around conservation gear options. Proposal 86 passed. That's a sport fish proposal. So while sport fishing in the Yukon area, if a salmon is removed from the water, it must be kept and counted towards bag and possession limits. Proposal 87 had to do with the definition of an eel stick, and it's a statewide definition that actually defines what an eel stick is, and the board will decide on that proposal at the statewide meeting because it's in the statewide definition section. Proposal 88 passed. And so that says that in the commercial fisheries during times of conservation, we can use selective gear types for commercial fishing and can require that a species be released alive by emergency order. And so it extends that same options to coho salmon, which weren't previously in our commercial gear, conservation gear regulations. In Proposal 89, the board took no action. This had to do with, we put in a proposal to clarify that you can operate a dip net with a line and attached to the handle. And enforcement said that according to their interpretation of the reg, that's already an allowable practice, and so the board didn't need to pass that proposal. So just to clarify, you can use a dip net with a line attached. Down on the lower Yukon, some people use that method of fishing to help fish deeper if they're dip netting for chum salmon, and they can keep chums that have to release kings alive. But this proposal generated kind of the most discussion because there's a video circulating of a young lady who's fishing with her family, and she's being really enthusiastic and bringing up fish and letting them, you know, letting the net bang against the side of the boat and dropping some fish on the deck. And so a lot of folks just wanted to remind everybody, all the stakeholders on the river, that if you're ever fishing with a conservation gear type, whether it's fish reels or dip nets or whatever, if you need to release a species alive, to, you know, everyone needs to just handle fish gently and carefully and really respectfully, and try to make sure that fish are never banging up against a boat or getting dropped on the deck of a boat. So it's kind of an interesting direction for the discussion to take at the board. Another point of discussion that's going to come up, I think later on at the board, is going to be, or there's going to be additional discussions about ordinary high water mark. So I mentioned that if we're restricting in times of conservation, if we're restricting gear, like say, you know, if we've got fishing open for non-salmon with 4-inch or smaller mesh restricted to 60 feet or less in length, we can also require that that gear be operated no more than 100 feet from the ordinary high water mark. And so that's when you're looking at the beach and you see, you kind of go from sand and gravel to rocks and then to maybe cut bank and vegetation. That's typically where the ordinary high water mark is. And we're going to need to be really mindful that there's certainly going to be some times of the year, particularly in fall, where when the water goes really far away, the water may be more than 100 feet away from the ordinary high water mark. And so that's going to be something that we'll probably have a lot more discussions on in the season, because the intent is not to keep people from fishing. The intent is just to make sure that those nets stay close to shore and so they're not far out in the water where they could potentially intercept king salmon. So, yeah, that'll be something that we'll probably have a lot more discussions on about this season if Christy and I do put that modification onto gear that's being used for fishing. So with that, let me know if you've got any questions about the Board of Fish proposal. I will say that there is a meeting coming up for the Alaska Peninsula Board. There's going to be a lot of discussion about Area M and interceptions of Yukon area fish at that meeting. The date for public comment submission was changed from February 3rd to February 6th. And so if anybody wants to comment on that Board of Fish meeting, there's still a little bit more time to do so. So yeah, thanks.
Are there any other updates from fishing game, fishing wildlife?
Real briefly, this is Shane Ransbury again, and just kind of in line with what Dina was talking about, you know, the sinking of gillnets proposal, which was 82, that got kicked out to statewide, but there were some amendments for it that came out in an RC that we're kind of like, what they're going to be talking about at statewide. So I just like to go over those real quick in case anybody wants to comment on them, because the comment deadline for that, for the statewide is, looks like February 23rd. But basically, the proposed changes for sinking of gill nets would be that in the personal use area over by Fairbanks, you would no longer be able to sink a gill net between May 1st and September 30th. So that would be basically just during the middle of the year before tide starts coming over. And then that would also apply for commercial fishing throughout the Yukon. So it would still be that you can no longer sink your net commercially from May 1st to September 30th. And then for subsistence, the change would be that in districts 1 and 2, it would be May 1 to September 30th, but in districts 3 through 6 in the Upper River, gill nets would still be allowed to be sunk below the surface, but they must have a red keg, buoy, or cluster of floats visible on the surface of the water at each end of the submerged net. And for submerged gill nets over 60 feet in length, a third red keg, buoy, or cluster of floats must be attached to the middle of the net. So that was kind of the compromise that they talked about between members of the board there, various stakeholders that are there, and YDFDA and your firm. So basically it's just been altered slightly under what's called RC 56, so that it would just restrict sinking the gill net between May 1st and September 30th for personal use, for commercial, and for subsistence just in districts 1 through 2, and then districts 3 through 6 would just have basically restrictions on, like they can still sink their net, but they need to take special steps to make sure it's clearly visible to folks. And then just real briefly, just getting back to the question you asked me earlier, I just wanted to update the date for the years I told you when we had low abundance for fall chum. That was in 1982 was the year when a really cold year reduced how many came back. And then the most recent crash, if you will, was 1998 to 2001. And then at the end of that, those fish ended up coming back with 9 fish came back for every spawner, which normally it's around like one fish comes back for every spawner. So, so even though there was very few fish in the water, they were quite productive, surprisingly so. So yeah, that's the end of our update. And then just remember that, for statewide, the comment deadline is February 23rd.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mark Nelson. I'm very recently got hired into the Northeast Area Biologist position for Fish and Game for Wildlife. I've been in this position about 4 days, so I'm a little behind the curve at the moment. But I was happy to see that this meeting was called and was looking forward to at least calling in, meeting you folks. And what I was kind of hoping to hear from you is what species, what areas, and, what concerns you guys have on the wildlife side of things. And the next time we meet, I'd be happy to bring a bunch of information back. I know that, Amanda Pope here is very interested in 40-mile caribou, which I can talk a little bit about, 40-mile caribou. And I know there's a lot of concern and interest about sheep in the brooks. We can talk a little bit about that. Yukon Flats moose, of course, is a very important moose population for everybody here. Porcupine caribou and Central Arctic caribou, I can talk about those as well. So anyway, I think with that, I'm just going to kind of leave it. If you guys have some questions, feel free to ask me. Otherwise, I look forward to hearing more from you guys, and then we'll, talk more in the future.
So, Mark, I got a question on moose and aerial counts. I was wondering, when was the last aerial survey done, and when do you think would be the next one? Would there be one this fall or winter?
That's a really good question. Fish and Game has not participated in aerial moose surveys in a while. I see that Mark Bertram's on the call. I don't know if the refuge has done anything recently, but I might punt that one over to Mark.
Hi, this is Mark Bertram. I am the wildlife biologist with Yukon Flats Refuge, and pleasure to join you on the meeting tonight. I can give you an update on where we are as far as moose surveys go. So So the refuge is, the refuge 25D west and east are all part of 25D. 25D east, the area towards Fort Yukon, was last surveyed in 2015. Areas to the west, 25D west, was last surveyed in 2018. And there is a plan for a survey in March in 25D west. So we hope to get another estimate of the moose population in that area in about another month. It's been very difficult doing moose surveys in recent years because we lack the snow early in the winter to pull these surveys off. We need about 5 to 10 to 12 inches to get the survey started, and it's very rare these days that we get that amount of snow by early November. This year we didn't have the snow this past October, November, so we decided to postpone the survey until March. And so we will get that information out to you once the data is collected. And if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Yeah, this is Mike. Before you, I got a question too for Fish and Wildlife. When are they planning the next moose management meeting? I know there hasn't been one for a while because of COVID and everything. I was wondering if anybody has any idea of where's that going or what's going to happen with that.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Michael. We don't have any moose management meetings planned for the imminent future. Those meetings were originally funded out of an annual funding agreement that we've got set up with Council of Athabascan Tribal Governments. And we did those meetings for many years. And then the agreement changed, and the projects that CATG is now funded to do are a variety of different projects, but they don't include the moose management meetings. So those funds for the moose management meeting were basically directed towards other projects that are being worked on now. And this doesn't mean that we can't have a moose management meeting. I think it's we need to meet and talk about moose management as often as we possibly can. And so I guess if there's interest in a moose management meeting, it would be great to hear discussion about that. And I could forward any information that you want me to pass on to the refuge manager as well. Thanks.
And with that, Mark, I know there's an agreement that was before, but I don't know, it probably went out with the funding also, and that was a quarterly newsletter from the Fish and Wildlife. And also too, maybe it'd be good to have a moose management meeting to find out where we're at. Not only that, but with all the predators we have now too, there's three or four different packs around there, with the wolves, numbers are growing, it'd be nice to have one to get an update of what's going on and what's happening out there.
No, that sounds fine, Michael. I think it's just a matter of communication, so it's just a matter of making a request and bringing it to, both Fish and Wildlife Services and Department of Fish and Game's attention that, it might be time to put a meeting together to have a discussion. And, that discussion could be a discussion that takes place as a separate meeting. It could be a discussion that takes place on, as part of the agenda for a meeting like we're at tonight or the next Eastern Interior RAC meeting, the Regional Advisory Council meetings that Fish and Wildlife puts on. So I think there's several ways to do that. I think the best way to get it started would just be for, for people who are interested in having a meeting to just communicate that either through me to the refuge manager or through our new biologist, Mark Nelson, and congratulations, Mark, on that position. And communicate through either myself or Mark that we'd like to get this meeting going. And so I'll be a conduit for the Fish and Wildlife Service for that.
Hey, Mark, this is
okay. Well,
I'm wondering if you could provide us an update on Well, I think BLM has taken the lead on this, but Fish and Game is also helping out. It has to do with the moose on the upper Dronchick and salmon fork of Dronchick. I know they did a cursory survey, and they have been deploying some collars. And what can you update us about that particular study?
I don't have a lot of information for you, Joe. The project is being managed by Jim Herrigus with BLM, and I have not talked with Jim in the last year about the project. I do know, as you know, there were collars deployed in the last year and a half, I think. But I haven't seen an updated report from Jim yet. Or a progress report on that. So I think we're probably going to have to, unless Mark knows something about it, we may have to approach BLM separately to get that question answered.
Yeah, and I don't know what Jim Herrigus has going with that project right now either.
I'll contact Jim Herrigus and let him know that there's interest in the status of that project, Joe, and let him know that it was brought up at the meeting tonight, and I'll let him, communicate that. So I'll let him know there's a need maybe to get the progress report out so folks can learn what the status of the movement study is.
Hey, Mark, this is Walter. I was just, I had a question on, creditor management. I'm just curious about, what are the techniques? Is it still creditor control out there taking place in the state, or is that still an effective method?
Well, I might let Mark handle that question. There's no predator control programs that are being sponsored by the refuge on the Yukon Flats at this time. And this, I know Alaska Department of Fish and Game has had various predator control programs across the state. But I'm not updated on the status of those projects. I guess I'd have to defer to Mark to maybe give us, maybe a better summary of what maybe going on.
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk a little bit about that. There are not very many active predator control programs right now. There are just a couple at this point. We've shut off the closest one to you guys was the 40-mile country for the 40-mile caribou herd. We haven't done any active wolf, harvest there in at least 2, maybe 3 years now. Across the state, that is an option. There's a pretty lengthy, involved process. A lot of factors we would have to look at before going down that road and bringing to the Board of Game, and then kind of letting, the Board of Game decide how to proceed with that, but that is, if that's kind of the direction you're looking at, we can talk about that for sure. But it's pretty, in some places it works well, in some places it doesn't. The one thing you got to keep in mind though, if a project gets going and a population of animals gets really big, it means there's going to have to be a whole lot of hunters there to harvest those animals. So that's just something to kind of keep in mind. It brings in a lot more people as well as animals, typically.
This is Mike here for Econ. Yeah, I think I might just put the word out that I was asking, and it'd be nice to get an update on where we're at with the moose management and the moose numbers, because Well, we don't want to have to end up, you know, having a moose crash also, you know, bad enough for fish are crashing, you know what I mean? You know, we can't take another species to make up for another one.
Yeah, Michael, I'll make sure that we get the results of this March survey out to you and your other village residents and Fort Yukon and the other Yukon Flats villages. That'll probably be coming out in probably May or early June at the latest, something like that. So we'll give you a status report on at least what's going on 25D West.
Yeah, that sounds good because we'd like to know what's out there. You know, thanks a lot.
Hello, this is Amanda Pope. I wanted to see if it's possible to also get your latest number information for moose.
Yeah, Amanda. Yeah, I'll provide that when we do the report. It'll have a summary of the moose results for 25D West. It'll have the results of all the previous surveys, and it'll also have several tables in there with all the most current numbers for 25D East. So it'll give you an idea of where the population was in 2015. And I guess I should add on to that when we get this survey done on 25D West, our intentions will be to partner up with the state and get 25D East done next. Because the weather is only allowing us to get these surveys pulled off about once every 3 years, you know, we'll shift over to the east after we get the west finished. So hopefully next year or the year after that, we'll be able to get 25D East completed as well.
All right, thank you. This is Amanda Pope again. Mark Nelson, were you the one that had said something about the 40-mile caribou herd?
Yeah, so I know you had called in, it sounds like, to the Eagle AC yesterday, and we're asking about that, and Jeff Gross, who manages that herd out of Tote, called me and just let me know. But just like the real kind of quick and dirty with that herd, it had grown over the past 20 some years, got up to around 80,000 caribou, which was way too many. We worked hard to bring that population down through harvest. We harvested a lot of animals in a few years. We did get a photo census in last summer, and that population looks like it's now right around 40,000 animals, which is a number we think is probably pretty good, pretty close to where that population should be. So the plan now is to just try and hold that population there. The quota will probably be about like it was this last fall, which was around 1,000, maybe just a little bit more than that, 1,200 animals, somewhere in there. So I would expect for the next year or two, the quota and kind of the harvest to be similar to how it was this last fall and winter.
Okay, so I am very concerned regarding the numbers. I think 40,000 is not adequate, but that's just my opinion. We used to see that herd come over this way towards Circle, and it used to cross at one point, it used to cross the Yukon River. And now they don't come over here anymore. And I think, I really haven't dug into the studies about why the numbers were dramatically dropped. And they're I just don't get why there's hunting available still for people when the numbers are so low. It's been 2 years since I've seen a caribou. My family and I and a lot of people here on this side of the Steese Highway, we don't hunt that herd just because the management is really bad. There has been a lot of waste from people who had harvested a caribou, and it's just disheartening to see that waste when it's so unsafe for us to hunt on federal land and even on state land. It's crazy. It just blows my mind how this hunt is continued when the numbers are low, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's terrible. Nobody likes to see that waste. And I don't know where it was or what kind of information you have, but I would, strongly encourage you to reach out to the troopers anytime you see something like that. I would myself, and I do. Like I said, Jeff Groats manages this herd. And when this group meets again, hopefully it's in person, but even if it's over Zoom, I'll make sure he's on the line and he can go into much more detail on, what we had seen in that herd and why it seemed like 80,000 was too many. Which it's all based on nutrition and body condition and stuff like that. But, like I said, I don't have all that information in front of me, but I'll definitely make sure those guys are, Jeff and maybe Torsten Benson, who's another one of our research biologists here. I'll make sure they're online for the next time and we could have a discussion about that.
I appreciate that. I also wanted to bring up, at the last, Eastern Interior, Eastern Iraq meeting, I was sitting in as a subsistence, user, just cause I was curious about, everything. And somebody called in and gave an update on the 40 mile caribou. And it seemed like to me that everybody, was concerned about the numbers. I noticed some Iraq board members that had wanted to have the manager of this 40 mile caribou herd attend the meeting, but unfortunately they did not attend the meeting to give an update to the Iraq. Can you please ask Jeff Gross to also attend the Iraq on the 1st and 2nd as be there in case the board members would like to ask any questions?
Yep, you bet. I'm drafting an email right now.
And can you ask him, please?
Yeah, sure.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Amanda.
This is Amanda Pope. I'm sorry, Michael. I just wanted to add that I had participated in the Hunter Liaison Program that Yukon Flats National Wildlife Refuge is partnered with CATG out of Fort Yukon. I got hired here in Circle. I worked for 3 years during the hunting seasons, and my job was to mitigate any concerns regarding competing with outside hunters, with local hunters, and I also did. So I tallied roughly 300 people a hunting season for 3 years. Somebody else had done it last year. But from my time working that position, I had noticed that that all the hunters that I encountered had not hunted that herd, and some did and some didn't. But the people who hadn't said it was really unsafe, and that's not including what the subsistence folks had been telling me also. And I just kind of wanted to make it aware that folks are not even hunting that because it's so unsafe, because of the lack of hunting practices, I guess, that people have when they hunt that herd. And it's very disrespectful to waste an animal. And I'm not including that it's illegal. I just have some really big concerns for that herd. And I thank you for being here to talk to the people here. And on that, I'd like to pass over to Michael.
Yeah, thank you, Amanda. I'll follow up with a comment on that. You did bring up a real good point, because I know there was a lot of wanton waste. You know, we have to deal with that too sometimes, the people that first-time hunters. Well, I think how to address the situation or what's happening is maybe that we brought it up before, you know, to the feds in the state, that maybe hunter education. And these people need to be asked if this is their first time hunting in Alaska or the first time in Alaska or even hunting. And that it should be mandatory that they go to a hunting course, at least a two or three day course, even a 1 day, a crash course, you know, on how to handle and take care of your meat. And then whatever you're not taking, bring back to give out. I mean, it seems like we're always having the ones to pay the price for somebody else's mistake. But other than that, yeah, I mean, I think there's a hunter education course that should be offered every time they issue a license, and then the question should be asked, is this your first time hunting? Are you from out of state? Are you in the military? You know, I mean, because there's a lot of traditional lands out there that we still go to, too, you know? And I'd just like to bring that up. Thanks.
Thank you, Mike. Hey, I want to get back on the agenda here. Are there any other fisheries or wildlife staff that need to make any updates? I got an email this week from Luke Rogers concerning bison Yukon Flats. Is he on this call?
This is Kyle Campbell from Board Support, and no, it doesn't look like Luke Rogers is on the call. I was hoping he was going to be able to attend as well. I can make sure to get the advisory committee contact info shared with Luke so he can reach out to you all. Mark Nelson, can you speak to the wood bison planning meetings at all, or should you just let Luke deal with that when he's able to talk to these guys?
We should probably let Luke. I'm trying to look up the dates real quick here for that one.
Mr. Rogers is over at the Westmark with a group of folks, stakeholders, talking about the Wood Bison Project right now. So he's up to his neck in busy work. So I'm pretty sure that he would be interested in the next agenda.
Yeah, that's correct. So what he's doing there now, he's talking about wood bison in the lower Tanana, and he's set a meeting to talk about potential wood bison into the Yukon Flats for 27 February to March 1st. It's a 3-day meeting. And I believe Luke was looking for the advisory committee to appoint somebody to attend that meeting.
Okay. Thank you, Mark. And if I recall from hearing Luke talk to a couple other advisory committees for some of these other planning meetings in different regions, I believe they've got some funding to bring a representative from UIC to the meeting, which I think is also held in Fairbanks, that February 27th to March 1st meeting.
I don't mean to take up much time, but just to FYI, the Eastern Interior Regional Advisory Council is happening in Arctic Village about that same time, I believe.
You're right, Ben. That meeting, for the record, this is Amanda Pope. I got recently appointed to that meeting, just to let you guys know, I got appointed to serve on the ERAC, and I'm very excited. But that meeting is located in Arctic Village this March on the 1st and the 2nd.
Okay, yeah, so there is a bison meeting in Fairbanks. At La Quinta from the February 28th to March 2nd, and they were looking for one of members from the Yukon Flats AC to join in on that meeting. You know, if there's anybody that wants to travel to Fairbanks during that time, we could pick that up right now.
Yeah, this is Mike. I'm kind of interested. That sounds interesting. You need more information on that?
So yeah, I got an email. I could probably forward it to you.
Okay.
Talking about reintroducing bison into Yukon Flats. So
they're kind of putting that on the table again. I remember old Buffalo Bob was doing that back quite a few years ago.
Hey, Mike, yeah, I'll nominate you if you're willing to go for that.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, this is Amanda Pope. I'd like to second that.
Hey, should we vote on it? Do we need a vote on that?
Sure. I think, as I understood it, the motion was made and seconded. You could either call for a unanimous consent, or you could ask for all the members on the call to give their yay or nay votes.
Yeah, I believe it's a unanimous consent, so we could just go ahead and carry on the agenda. Let's take care of. And I was wondering, is there any other updates from ADF&G staff? If not, we could carry on an agenda looking at the elections for vacant and expired seats.
And this is Kyle Campbell from Board Support again. I believe that first agenda item A there was kind of taken, like we talked about before, the meeting was called to order. For any community designated seat, those can happen at a meeting without a quorum. And so the way this meeting kind of played out, those elections, I think that agenda item kind of bumped itself up before the meeting was called to order. And I'm putting together the election record for those newly elected and reelected members now, and I'll distribute that with the folks. But if you'd like me to just read that off for the record so that it's there in the audio recording, what I have down is that members Walter Peter and Amanda Pope were nominated themselves to be reelected and will serve a 3-year terms, in addition to, or, you know, continuing on from the current terms you're serving, in addition to the two of you, Michael Peter, Rhonda Pitka, and Sly Blackbird were elected to serve on this committee today.
Okay, there are some communities that have vacant seats that there need to be elections taking place, so I think that sooner the better. So how do we go about doing those elections, I mean, in those communities?
That's a great question. And again, for the record, this is Kyle Campbell with Board Support. And so in my experience and having looked at how some different advisory committees throughout the state that have a similar makeup as yours, where there's a handful of different communities spread out across the map that are on the AC. Typically elections for a given community for those designated seats would happen within that community. Although they don't have to. So if there were additional nominations that any of the members on the call currently wanted to put forward, before those could be sort of officiated, the nominee would have to be contacted and would have to say, yes, they're willing to serve. So if you wanted to go that route, we could. What we can also do is try and get a bit more, public engagement and outreach in getting either separate elections held in those communities that still have vacant seats, or if, like we discussed earlier, if we're wanting to arrange like an in-person meeting in one community, or even to bring members into Fairbanks, as I know this committee has done in the past. We could schedule that as an election meeting at whatever point that happens later on this spring. And I do have a list that Rhonda Pitka had sent me earlier this year of folks from several different communities that were interested in serving. Again, the only real requirements from the regulations within the Alaska Administrative Code for Fish and Game Advisory Committees is that elections must be publicly held and given 2 weeks advance notice to the public. So that applies whether those elections are kind of hosted by Fish and Game Board Support Section, like this teleconference is today, or more traditional face-to-face election meetings that Fish and Game hosts, or if those elections are hosted within a given community by either tribal government or another organization. So long as there's a 2 weeks public notice given and that any member from the public who resides in that community or the area served by the committee has the opportunity to put forth nominations and cast votes. As long as that happens, there's kind of multiple ways to skin this cat.
Okay, so you'll reach out to those communities, huh? Continue reaching out to them until we do get a response, nominations.
Yeah, that's correct. And great to have Ben Stevens on the call today. It sounds like he's going to circle back to this committee after he talks with the tribal government in Stevens Village. I have not made many inroads yet with the Vinatai or Chalkitsik, and I have not heard back from the members whose terms are set to expire this summer from Arctic Village, Gerald John and Faith Gemmel or Gemmel.
Okay, so we also have officer elections on the agenda. Which offices are we needing? Chair, secretary?
I'd like to speak to that. So there are three officer positions that are outlined in the same section of the Alaska Administrative Code that kind of governs the makeup of Fish and Game Advisory Committees. So the three officer positions would be a chair, a vice chair, and a records keeper or secretary. I'd be happy to kind of give more description of the duties for each of those. I think most of the folks on this call might kind of understand those already, but the chair would be the person that kind of is in the role that you're serving today as acting chair, calling the meeting to order, working through the agenda, and also the chair is usually the first point of contact that works with myself or the board support staff to plan meetings, schedule meetings, make sure that the any invited guests or presenters are kind of all in the, involved in that conversation and planning. If there is going to be travel, it really helps to have several weeks to work with to so that we can kind of make the necessary arrangements. And that also includes, you know, things as simple as just kind of getting a meeting agenda and other packets of information printed and mailed out to members so that folks have them in hand. The vice chair serves as sort of a backup for the chair. The vice chair can call a meeting to order or can call for a meeting in the absence of a chair. And then the secretary is their primary role is to record and submit the meeting minutes within 30 days of each regularly scheduled meeting. And I'm very happy to help work with whoever is willing to step up to that role to kind of get the process kind of figured out. It can be daunting, I think, for someone who's new to doing meeting minutes. It's definitely advisable that members of the committee record those minutes and not the department staff. I try to be as neutral and unbiased as possible, but it's not my place to record meeting minutes. So I'm very happy to kind of help with that process. We do now maintain audio recordings for just about every AC meeting, so those really help in getting those meeting minutes put together. And we also have quite a few helpful templates that are on our board support website. I will send that out to folks. And in addition, I will put some, we have an updated advisory committee manual that I will get mailed out to those members that were reelected and newly elected to the advisory committee today.
Yeah, so right now we have three communities that are not present in this meeting, and I don't know if this is the correct time to do the officer elections right now, or should we wait till we have a full AC question on AC? So, what do other members think on this?
This is Kyle Campbell from board support, and I certainly understand where you're coming from with wanting to make sure that there's a sort of representation from all of the advisory or from all the communities that have designated seats on this advisory committee. And so I think that's really up to you and the other members currently on the call, how you want to move forward with the sort of holding officer elections today or not. From the board support perspective, it is pretty helpful to kind of have a point of contact to kind of start the process for getting meetings going. I think that it's just very helpful. But again, I definitely don't want to sort of force your hand in feeling like you need to move forward with electing a chair or a vice chair today. If there was someone currently on the call that felt comfortable sort of stepping up to serve as that records keeper, that would be a great, that would be the most help for me as a board support staff person to kind of know who I can work with on getting the meeting minutes from today's meeting put together.
Mr. Chairman, it's Mike. Oh, go ahead.
Yes,
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mike. Mr. Chairman, Ben Stevens here. I think that that whoever's on this call is supposed to be on this call, and I think that we've got the talent here. I see you as a perfect person for a chair, and Amanda is very active and knowledgeable. I would be willing to step up and help that record-keeping function in whatever role I play for this AC. I'm chatting with Mr. Randy Mayo right now, and I believe he's going to be one of those seats, I believe, but I've yet to confirm again. So, Mr. Chairman, I would go ahead because you've got talent, something to start with here. And we can only make it stronger after that. I'll help with the other villages.
Sounds good, Ben. I think so. So we should go ahead and continue with the lecture. Gary,
Mr. Chair, can I make a comment?
Yes, go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, I think it sounds good to me, but out of all fairness, though, I think we need to reach out to some of these villages, too. You know, I know there's a lot, some of the seats have been vacant for a while, you know, and they haven't been active. And I think a concern to me, I think that we need to pull somebody in from the other villages just to make sure that they know what's going on, out of fairness, you know. Because I don't want them trying to come back and say, hey, I didn't know about this, I didn't know about this or that, and didn't know, you know. Just out of fairness, make sure we reach out to the each tribal council, each village council, to let them know that, hey, you know, these your guys' seats are open, and it's, and they play an important role as part of this, you know, our AEC.
Mr. Chairman, Ben here. Well put, Mike. I totally agree with that. I also think that we need to have a structure in place and some, like a chairperson and a secretary treasurer type person pulling moves and making things happen, helping Kyle out to get our voices out there. Because I think that we've been stalled for a little too long. So respectfully, Mike, I say that we've got the right people in the room right now. And
I'm not speaking against that, Ben. I'm just saying we need to reach out too, though, you know, to others. Some of these seats have been vacant for a while and inactive. I'm with what we have in place now with Chuck as a chair and then Amanda as vice and the directors. I'm up for that. Is that like we mentioned before, we talked, you know, more involvement. You know, we had to get, you know, put a fire into these people. You know.
Yeah, I hear that and I appreciate that. I just don't know how else to go because I was working with Mr. Bruce Thomas as he's got that regional reach there at CATG. He was pushing me to hold AC trainings for our folks, and we couldn't get anyone there. Mrs. Amanda Pope there was I think the only one, and I think you were there. So it's, I mean, we've got plane tickets and training sessions for everybody, but no one's showing up. So after this, I will work with my day job outfit and Mr. Bruce Thomas at CATG and Pachaje to reach Chalkeetsik, Arctic Genitai. So respectfully said.
Thank you, Ben.
Yeah, and as part of that, too, if you can, I can be able to help on the reaching out part, too, you know. But I know some people in the villages that I can talk to.
Okay, so I think I want to make a motion to go ahead and hold elections at this meeting right now.
A second.
Okay, so we'll vote on it. Vote on having the elections. This current meeting. Kyle, can you go ahead and do the roll call?
Oh, sure. Yep. So, sorry, I wasn't sure if you're waiting for me or not. Again, this is Kyle Campbell with Board Support. So if I understand correctly, you put a motion on the floor. It's been seconded to hold officer elections during the meeting today.
Yes.
Okay. There are currently four members on the call, Michael Peter, Walter Peter, Amanda Pope, and Sly Blackbird. Do you want me to call for unanimous consent or go down the roll?
That's up to you.
Okay. Maybe just for the sake of brevity, if there are any of the four members on the call who are not in favor of going forward with officer elections today, can you please make that known now? I believe the motion carries by unanimous consent. And I'll just give a little bit of background on the kind of normal process for officer elections. And a point that I meant to raise earlier that Ben Stevens stepping in saying that he'd be willing to help in that records keeper role. The secretary or records keeper officer role is the only officer position that does not have to be a member of the committee. It can be anyone who's willing to do that work. So as long as the members of the committee that are in this meeting are in support or, you know, the majority of the members would vote for a non-currently serving member to be the secretary, that is allowed within regulations. Similar to elections to fill seats, officer elections, someone can nominate themselves or nominate others for any of the three officer roles I've outlined already. There's not a need for a second on a nomination. You can just make a nomination. And if there are more than one member nominated for a particular role, then there would be a vote among members for to see who receives the most votes. If there's if it's an uncontested nomination, then that that nominee would be seated in that officer position.
So shall we open up the table for nominations?
Mr. Chairman, I really appreciate your patience with me, but to move things along, this sounds odd, but I will nominate myself to be that that record keeper person. As much as I hate paperwork, I will do that as a non-member right now. So that'll free all of you up to do your work. So.
And I'll nominate myself for the chair. I'd also like to nominate Amanda Pope for vice chair.
Second.
Hi, this is Amanda Pope. I'm sorry, Sly. I believe we had already voted on the chair and the vice chair, and I second Ben's nomination for himself to be the secretary. And I really appreciate you stepping up, Ben. Thank you.
And I thank you, Amanda. However, I am just the record keeper, not the secretary position of the board. So,
okay.
Like I said, that'll free you folks up to do that, and I'll help from the outside.
Thank you, Dave.
Again, from board support, just to clarify, records keeper and secretary are synonymous, and the term for the officer in the regulations as listed is secretary. Internally, we often refer to that role as a records keeper, mostly just because there's some gender bias in different parts of the state. But they serve the same. So just so that you understand, Ben, what I have down is that you nominated yourself to serve as the advisory committee secretary. At least person steps forward to serve that role.
You know, all these rules and regulations is complicating things. So if you say I have to be the secretary treasurer, then so be it.
Okay. And just to clarify, there is no treasurer role on advisory committees, but for the Fish and Game Advisory Committee. So it would really just, the role of the secretary or records keeper really is just to work with the chair and the vice chair and the regional coordinator from board support to get timely meeting minutes submitted after each meeting.
Roger that. Mr. Chair, forward.
Okay, so does that conclude our elections? Have we covered in that area, Kyle?
I believe so. If there were no other nominations put forward, I've got one nomination for chair, one nomination for vice chair, and one nomination for secretary/records keeper, and those would all go uncontested unless anyone else puts the nomination in before you close nominations.
Okay, so hearing none, I'd like to close nominations.
Thank you, and I will get these records. I'm updating the election record with all this information as we go. I'll get this sent out to members as quickly as possible after today, and I think you can move on to the remaining agenda items as you see fit.
Okay, so next on the agenda is National Park Service proposal to amend hunting and trapping regulations in national preserves in Alaska. There's a big regulation that I believe it was switched in 2015. It was changed in 2015, then they changed again in 2020. So, you know, a lot of the old regulations were already aligned with the NOFA, I believe. And, you know, I don't know if there's any more clarification on these regulations. Is there anybody there that can help us with this area? Kyle, have you noted up on this, all these regulations in the National Park Service?
Hi, everyone. This is...
Go ahead, man. I was just going to say that I don't see the Park Service on the call.
Yeah, this is Amanda Pope for the record. I had requested this to be added to the agenda. I can read the proposal, the press release that the subsistence coordinator had given me from the Yukon Charlie National Preserve. And it says the NPS seeks public input on proposed changes to the 2020 hunting and trapping regulation on national preserves in Alaska. It says proposed rule would alleviate public safety concerns and reduce user conflict. In Anchorage, Alaska, the National Park Service today announced today as of, I don't see the date then on this, on the 9th of 2023. And it says that today they announced a proposal to amend regulations for the hunting and trapping on national preserves in Alaska. The proposed regulation would reverse the 2020 Alaska hunting and trapping rule, which authorized several controversial sport hunting practices, including bear baiting. The new regulation would reduce visitor use conflicts and concerns over potential safety issues related to the bear baiting, and would also restore consistency between harvest practices allowed in the national preserves and NPS management policies with respect to natural possessions, abundances, and wildlife behavior. The new rule would also properly reflect the federal government's authority to regulate hunting and trapping on national preserves in Alaska. And then towards the bottom, it says the proposed regulations would only apply to hunting and trapping on Alaska National Preserves, federal subsistence harvest in national parks and preserves in Alaska would not be affected by the proposed changes, they say. But, let's say if you had a family member in an area such as Fairbanks that is not federally qualified and who still practices, who still practices bear baiting with you as a member of the subsistence, hunter. So this rule would not be, it would make it to where they wouldn't be able to participate. And it also had something about the caribou. I didn't read the whole regulations, it's not in front of me right now, but I'm just reading the Park Service news release that they put out. And I just thought I'd bring it up to the board, and I see Jim Simon has his hand raised. Go ahead, Jim.
Thank you, Amanda, and through the chair. Yes, Amanda did a great job summarizing this proposed rule. Just to clarify a few points. This is a proposed rule that the Park Service is doing outside of the Federal Subsistence Board program and the Federal Subsistence Management program more generally. If some of you recall back in 2008, when Craig Fleener was appointed to the Board of Game and CACG had been trying to reduce some of the black bear populations, et cetera, in order to build up your moose population, Craig Fleener, as a member of the Board of Game, directed the Division of Subsistence to revise the black bear and brown bear customary and traditional use worksheets to better reflect indigenous predator management techniques. And after the Board of Game adopted those, they adopted subsistence hunting regulations under the state system that allowed taking bears from dens, for example, which is a real Koyokan, Danaka, customary and traditional use, especially along up and down the Koyokuk River. And the Park Service sort of went crazy over that idea. And so back in, they prohibited these new state subsistence methods of taking some predators, that the Park Service then prohibited, so sort of trumped the Board of Game's regulations for state subsistence. Then our congressional delegation got involved, et cetera. It ended up being a big, huge deal. And then the Park Service had a change in presidential, a new president was elected, and they reversed those decisions in 2020. And the Alaska Wildlife Alliance, I believe that's the name of the environmental group, that sued the National Park Service on that reinstatement of some of those state subsistence allowances for taking bears and wolves. It was litigated. And basically, the courts recently determined that there was a legal flaw in how those were allowed again. So in response, the Park Service has once again, under a different presidential administration, is now again trying to restrict those activities. They are saying that it's only sport uses, but as Amanda very eloquently explained, they're ignoring the fact that not all Indigenous people are federally qualified any longer. If you've moved to Fairbanks, then all of a sudden you wouldn't be able to return home to participate in that activity with your federally qualified relatives or friends. So the bigger issue that Amanda mentioned with the prohibition of taking swimming caribou, that is presently only allowed under state subsistence hunting regulations in Unit 23, you know, in Northwest Alaska. So that's a much bigger issue for them. But as you guys all know, you know, taking animals as they cross the Yukon River used to be a customary and traditional method, but it's not been recognized by state or federal governments in your area, in the Yukon Flats. So some of this is not really biologically driven. It's driven by this lawsuit and sort of the values of avoiding and trying not to actively manage predator populations to boost the animals that more people eat. So the tribal consultation is currently underway also for this new proposed rule. The Park Service first brought it up last spring, but they wouldn't have any formal tribal consultation until the proposed rule was published in the Federal Register, which seems odd. One would think that they should consult with the tribes before developing the proposed rule and then publish it. So in any event, I'm not sure that there is much that public comment can do to address this issue. For those of you who, again, have followed this over in the past 10 or so years, when in 2015 they prohibited these, taking of bears from dens, for example, other environmental groups then realized, oh wait, they've only prohibited it on national preserves for sports hunters. What about the subsistence hunters? And that's when we had, in 2017, that Florida Animal Rights Group had submitted a proposal to eliminate the state subsistence practices of taking the big hairy animal from dens. And that's the BENS program, you know, the tribal what's now the Tribal Resources Stewardship Program, took a whole group of people down and ended up educating those Florida-based animal rights representatives, and they ended up withdrawing the proposal because they hadn't really understood that allowing the take of a sow with cubs was basically just in case they happened upon a den that had a sow and cubs and had to take the animals because of public safety, you know, during the hunt, and that it wasn't actually going to be used for people to now go target sows and cubs in, while they're denning. So the fear is that with this sort of political, you know, ball game here going back and forth between administrations, is that once the Park Service does that, we very well may see other proposals submitted to the Board of Game that would then try to remove the subsistence uses that are under discussion. Sorry, that it's really long-winded, and I apologize. It's very complicated history, and I have had discussions with the lead person for the Department of Interior here in Alaska, right under Raina Thiel, who is also frustrated at how this has come about and that tribes were not consulted before the proposed rule came out. But it does, there is the 60-day clock on public comment period has begun. I think that runs until March sometime. I don't have that up in front of me right now.
Jim, it's March 10th. This is Amanda.
Oh, great. Thank you, Amanda. So with that, enough. Enough from me. Thanks.
Thanks, Jim. This is Amanda Pope. My family and I had personally fought the Park Service for 2 years, and it ended up being, we went up the ladder, and it ended up being somebody from, Washington, D.C., flying in the circle and talking with us personally with our permit, because it had to do with us practicing our subsistence rights on federal lands, and we won it. And we are continuing our permit. And right now I'm just concerned with the Park Service restricting us more. As Jim had had done the overview, I just think I personally had done a comment, and I encourage you all to do the same if you are interested in this proposal that the Park Service is putting in. I'm not sure what this board can do, but I just wanted to bring it to you guys' attention. Thank you.
So, as the AAC, should we take up this proposal? Proposal. Any other comments from AC members?
Hi, this is Amanda Pope again. Is it possible if the AC can do a comment to NPS, Kyle?
Yeah, this is Kyle Campbell with Board Support Section, and I believe so. I just recently was talking with the Board of Game Executive Director, Christy Tibbles, about whether or not fishing game advisory committees as an entity can make comments to the Federal Subsistence Board. And I believe I didn't have a direct discussion about making comments on National Park Service proposals, but I believe it would kind of fall into that same category. It's not super common, but there's definitely no reason why you as an advisory committee, especially if you took that action during a meeting in which a quorum was held, which would be now, that you couldn't I think it would, yes, if you wanted to put a motion on the floor to you know, take a vote on and submit comments to the Park Service on any of their proposals, that would be appropriate.
Yeah, this is Mike here. Yeah, I think I would probably, work, not only for us, but our tribal members also. You know, I mean, we're in the middle of a refuge, but other villages are surrounded by parks also, too, you know, and I think that anybody that has the Alaska Native has a right to subsist and feed their families. I don't think any rights should be taken away. I think it should be protected. And actually, they should be encouraged to go back home and hunt, with everything that's going on, it seems like they're putting more regs in. We're one of the most regulated tribes in the nation, We can't need regulations, we're regulated enough.
So which part of the regulation is what you're looking at, Amanda? Is it the whole regulation or just parts of it?
Well, from my understanding, they want to get rid of the... So it says right here, this proposed rule would align our efforts to better manage national preserves lands in Alaska for natural purposes, as well as address public safety concerns associated with bear baiting. I am not for them doing this proposal, personally, just because it restricts, a lot of folks around the land. So.
So a lot of the regulation always goes back in quotes in ELCA and being a qualified subsistence user. So, yeah, I'm a little confused on this. There's a lot of wording.
Mr. Chairman, Ben Stevens here. I don't think that we probably have a clear enough idea of the whole issue, and I'm sad that we don't have anyone here from NPS to help us better understand this. I think what Amanda is saying is that that she opposes the NPS doing this, and I think that Amanda helped me here that you're wanting maybe the AC to opine on it.
Well, I just wasn't sure. Excuse me. I just wasn't sure if the AC would be interested in doing a collaborative vote, or in support of not going, in support of not allowing Park Service to do this rule. But I'm not sure how we would even submit that online to NPS, Kyle. I'm not exactly sure how that process is.
Well, I can probably speak to that. And again, this is Kyle Campbell with Board Support, for the record. So I'm not super familiar with the National Park Service sort of proposal process. I definitely am more familiar with the Board of Game and the Board of Fish process. Though just reading through that document that I had attached to the meeting notice that kind of describes, I think it's the same one Amanda's reading off of, that describes the summary of the rule change, and just so we're all clear on the record, this would be the National Park Service 36 CFR Part 13 RIN 1024-AE70, and that is the rule that Amanda was just speaking to, it as well as Jim. The proposed rule would prohibit certain harvest practices, including bear baiting, and prohibit predator control or predator reduction on national preserves. And again, their comment deadline looks like it's March 10th, and I believe there's two ways to submit the comment, either through their portal online or by mail, and I've got some specifications on what kind of will automatically make a comment not be accepted, like if it's not submitted in the correct format. or without the correct language. So that is something that myself and the other board support staff can certainly help. So what I might suggest, if it is the intention of this committee or the members on this committee present in the meeting today, to move forward with what it sounds like Amanda has outlined, someone could make a motion to put forward a comment on this National Park Service proposal, expressing the concerns that Amanda has raised. You don't need to have that language finalized now. It might be good to sort of plan on having another meeting of this advisory committee prior to that March 10th submission deadline, just to get everybody else another opportunity to weigh in on it, as well as to maybe have time to draft something and share it with the committee members for review. But you could pass a motion today with that intent to put your comments on the record, and I can certainly help with the formatting and submission of it once that's done.
Mr. Chairman, this may be out of line, but I would just say so moved.
Yes, I agree. I think we need a little more clarification. It states in elk over and over again. So I think the big fight is over fairness. What purposes, what it proposes, but yeah, I'd like to just move on and we could get more clarification. Maybe you could, maybe Kyle could email us or mail us some more clarification on this so we'd have a better understanding before March 10th comes around.
I'd be happy to print out a copy of this, this document and mail it, and I was just checking to see, so at least one National Park Service staff person was invited to this meeting, but I will, I'll follow up with them and see if we can't get, it's definitely out of my wheelhouse to speak to this National Park Service proposal, but I'd be happy to get any materials requested by the committee printed and mailed to all of you.
This is Amanda Pope. I'd like to invite Marcia Cotta. She's the subsistence coordinator for the National Park Service, and she's I'd like to invite her to the next meeting. So she would probably be the person that would be talking about this with us.
This is Kyle Campbell again. Marcy is who I just went and looked in. She did receive the invitation for this meeting. I didn't speak with her directly. I'm not sure if she is on leave currently. I can find out. But I'll try and get in touch with her next week and let her know that this is an issue that's really important to this advisory committee. And I may ask her to reach out to some of you directly. That may help kind of move the process along. And definitely to make sure she's able to attend your next advisory committee meeting.
Okay, sounds good, Kyle. So we'll be moving on to the next agenda item, Board of Fisheries proposals for Alaska Peninsula region. I believe there's a proposal in the packet, proposal 140, but it's a proposal on the Aleutian Islands fishing, so I don't think it has any, it's completely out of our area. They do state that there might be some other fisheries, but again, I'm not familiar with Sugamak Island.
This is Dina Jalas.
Go ahead, Jan.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to add that Proposal 140 was proposed by the Fairbanks Advisory Committee, And I haven't dug into it too deep because, yeah, it's not my fishery. It's outside of our area. But that is a proposal that has come up at a lot of other ACs. A lot of other ACs have read it and discussed it and, you know, tried to think about whether this would be a measure that seeks it to reduce commercial fishing time in Area M, and that may reduce the number of Western Alaska chum that are caught in that fishery. So, like, all the details about it, I tried to listen to a False Path AC meeting this afternoon to kind of hear one of their biologists talk about it to understand more about those proposals, but that meeting was canceled because they didn't have quorum. So, unfortunately, I'm not a manager for that area. I'm not familiar with their management plan and their regulations, but this is a proposal that was proposed by the Fairbanks AC, and a lot of other ACs have discussed it, and that's probably why it's in your packet.
Mr. Chairman, Ben Stevens here. Just for your info, the basic gist that other ACs are looking at is that a lot of the salmon that come through that False Pass area, Area M, I get mixed up in all the verbiage, but the idea is that all the salmon that coming through that area is going to the western coast of Alaska and to the Yukon, the Cusco, and so forth. And considering the fact that there are no salmon in those rivers, the idea is that if that fishery down there at False Pass let a few more through, maybe we'll get some fish on the Yukon. So a lot of other ACs are in support of Proposal 140.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought also. And I was looking at the scheduling, and it reduces the time just by maybe 8 hours or so.
Yeah.
So if this AC wants to take up this proposal, we could go ahead and talk about it, or just all vote on supporting it.
I think we should vote on it.
Is there a motion?
This is Amanda Pope. I make a motion to support 140. Proposal 140.
Yeah, this is Mike. I'll second that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Yep, my name is Jim Simon. I'm a consultant with Tanana Chiefs Conference Tribal Resource Stewardship Program. I work for Ben Stevens. I just would like to share some brief summary comments about Proposal 140. In the past, some of you may remember 20-some years ago, this was a big issue. The last time our Yukon River and other Arctic Yukon Kuskokwim chum salmon populations went into steep decline, collapse. And back then, there was the Board of Fish spent something like 4 years working on a solution to try to reduce the interception of Yukon River-bound chum salmon, as well as chum salmon in Norton Sound, Kuskokwim River, and Bristol Bay. And that was adopted by the Board of Fish during the Tony Knowles administration and was in place from 2001 to 2004, or 2003. And then in 2004, under a new governor, a new Board of Fish really dramatically liberalized that false pass fishery. They increased the area that could be fished in the June season when so many of our chum are migrating through there back to the Bering Sea. And they also increased their commercial fishing time from 3 16-hour commercial fishing periods per week to now the each period is up to is 88 hours long. So proposal 140, if the board adopted it, would just revert back to that management plan from 2001 to 2003 that would limit their commercial fishing opportunities to no more than 3 16-hour commercial openings per week. And it would reduce, it would take back the areas that had been opened up, beginning in 2004 that increased the chances of them intercepting our chum salmon. So there are a number of other proposals that are all trying to reduce the Area M's interception of chum salmon and other salmon bound for other areas. But the proposal 140 looks like a good compromise in part because it's already been the management plan. It just is reverting back to a previous management plan that was in regulation. And so that the big picture as far as how it relates to you in the Yukon Flats is that the last genetic study from like 2007 and 2009 demonstrated that of those chum salmon that are intercepted in Area M, 57% of them on average were destined to return to coastal Western Alaska. So that's Bristol Bay, Kuskokwim, Yukon, and Norton Sound chum salmon rivers. There was a previous study done in the early 2000s that demonstrated that in those days it was 44%. The department began collecting genetic data in 2022 and just released that report. And now the information is suggesting that it's either 12 or 13% of those harvested chum salmon are destined to return to coastal Western Alaska. So they're probably going to use that information to suggest that their impact on our chum is so much smaller now. But the reality is our chum salmon populations have collapsed. So the probabilities of them finding a chum, one of our chum salmon in their fishery is so much lower. So in any event, this is going to be a real challenging struggle next month. I know Ben and his leadership at Tanana Chiefs Conference are taking a contingent of people down to testify to try to get these this interception better managed so that we might meet chum salmon escapement goals and to be able to provide you some opportunity to subsistence fish. Because the state subsistence priority law says that if there's if there's not a sufficient allowable harvest of Yukon River chum salmon, the first thing that the Board of Fish is supposed to do is to eliminate non-subsistence uses. That's right out of the law, 1605-258B4 specifically. And the reality is, you're not meeting escapement goals, you're not having any subsistence fishing opportunities, and yet the commercial fleet in Area M is still intercepting some of your chum salmon and selling them commercially. And that's a problem that hopefully passage of Proposal 140 will fix. Hopefully that helps give you some of the background. Thank you.
Thank you for that clarification. I think that we'll go ahead and vote on this proposal. So all who support Proposal 140, signal by signal by saying aye.
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 Aye. Move to oppose. Signal by saying aye. Okay, motion passes. The Yukon Flats will support proposal 140. Okay, so we'll take carry on here in the agenda for the game call. The proposal of Interior 2023 to 2024,
is that the next cycle? So this is kind of the section, and I can speak to that. So the call for proposals has not yet been published, but we expect it to be out from the first week of February. Though we do know the submission deadline will be May 1st, 2023. And so this item is on your agenda just to really begin the conversation within the members of your committee. If there were any wildlife or game regulation changes that you would like to put before the Board of Game for their Interior Region meeting next year, as you know, the Board of Game meets different regions on a three-year basis. So Interior Region comes up every 3 years. And so this is the kind of the big year, the next time that the Board of Game will be considering Interior Region proposals will be in the 2026-2027 regulatory year. So if there were any changes to hunting regulations or with anything that's within the regulatory jurisdiction of the Board of Game, that it would be great to kind of start that conversation now within your advisory committee, to start at least thinking about topics that you might want to work with your new area biologist, Mark Nelson, to kind of get proposals together and with board support assistance as well. You could submit proposals on behalf of your advisory committee before that May 1st deadline.
Hello everyone, this is Amanda Pope. I have like 10 proposals that I would like to do. Maybe 11. Let me just kind of read through a few of them and see what you guys think. The first one is I'd like to make a proposal to cut the antlers in half in order, or the antlers of a caribou in half in order to get less pressure and to help with wanton waste, because the majority of the folks that I've seen are just out there for trophy hunting, and I think keeping it mandatory for the 40-mile herd to cut the antlers in half will mitigate any it will help with wanton waste and with the pressure that we've had on that herd. Any comments on that idea? I'm not sure how much time I'd like to go through all these, but I just kind of wanted to get your guys' opinion on my ideas so I could make the proposals and then bring it back to you guys with it.
Yeah, it sounds like a good idea. A good proposal for sure. You want to go ahead?
Yeah, that sounds good. Well, if we can get a copy of the ones you're thinking about, redoing, we're changing the wording.
Right.
This is Amanda Pope for the record. I am planning to just write these proposals out, and I will see if see if somebody is willing to help me reword it all, and I could bring it back to the AC, and then kind of get everyone's vote on supporting it or not then, instead of taking a whole bunch of time now on each of the ideas. I don't know how much time you guys had, but I think that's probably the best idea. I'm not sure. I'll wait for your comment.
This is Mike. Go ahead, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I was looking at the board game proposals, and you know, it closes May 1st, I believe Kyle said. So, you know, it might be a good idea to have another meeting before then. You know, maybe there are other proposals that we could submit. So there's a question on whether we could call another meeting, you know, in a month or two.
Yeah, this is Mike there. Yeah, I think that would be a good idea. And it'd be good to get a copy of the original and then maybe a copy of the changes you're wanting to make. And then maybe we could all look at it, you know, and then if anybody has any ideas, you know, and their wording or anything, and then maybe, I know CATG is supposed to provide technical assistance, but I mean, I don't know if anything's really going on with them or not, but other than that, I think, maybe we can find out and reach out to them too, and then, if we can, you know, get some, little help on that.
Mr. Chairman, Ben Stevens here, I guess to add to that, we can, probably, sit down and chat a little bit more with Amanda to help flesh out some of those ideas with, of course, ADF&G's expertise and experience. I'm pretty sure we could help draft up some ideas, some of her ideas, into proposals. So, if you want to schedule a meeting, feel free. We'll try desperately to get those ideas on paper with ADF&G's help before that meeting.
Yeah, sounds great, Ben. This is Amanda. I look forward to reaching out to you guys, Ben and Jim. I appreciate you offering to help. And then I could bring it to this AC board and see if they would be willing to be in support of the proposals or not. Thank you.
Kyle Campbell, when was the deadline on those proposals? Was it May 1st?
That's correct, yeah. You can expect the actual call for proposals to be posted sometime in the next couple weeks, and that'll kind of give some more general information on the proposal submission format. If you've seen a board of game call for proposals in the past, it's going to be pretty identical, where there's no big changes to the proposal submission process. And that proposal submission deadline will be May 1st, 2023. And I would also be happy to work with Amanda and to kind of get the proposal ideas she has. Sounds like a good list of them, to get those drafts started and distributed to the members of this committee so that you all can review them prior to your next meeting.
So I was thinking that, you know, if we could get these elections done in the other communities before March, and we can have a meeting in March to discuss proposals with the full AC. Is that something that we can do?
That is definitely what from the board support perspective, we would love to help make happen. So I will continue to work with the local tribal governments in the communities that aren't represented here today. I can kind of work with you over the next coming weeks as to scheduling the next advisory committee meeting, and whether you wanted to host that in one of the communities represented by your advisory committee, or, like I mentioned earlier, we could, I believe in the past, this advisory committee has met in Fairbanks. We have the budget to kind of do one big meeting with travel. Unfortunately, we don't have the budget to do multiple meetings with air travel, bringing members into one place. But I do believe I have approval to arrange either charter a plane to bring members to one single community, or to kind of get folks on scheduled flights to Fairbanks and put you up in a hotel so that you can meet at a meeting venue in Fairbanks. And that would be, I think, a great way to kind of get maybe the ball rolling on some of these proposal ideas. The only downside with the board support travel is it can be tricky with the, trying to do that for elections. We don't, it's kind of a gray area on how, like, if a member gets elected at a meeting, then they're a member and they can get a flight home from board support. We can talk more about it as we have a date in mind. The best, solution would be to get those vacant seats on those communities that aren't represented here today, to try and get those elections held within those communities. Those elections do not need to be a full advisory committee meeting in which a quorum is present. So, for example, if there were an election held in Arctic Village, it could just be for the two Arctic Village seats, and the only folks attending that meeting could be just members from the community of Arctic Village. So I will continue to work with Vinatai and Arctic Village and Chalkitsik, and I really appreciate Ben Stevens offering to kind of continue working with them, seeing if we can't get some new membership on this committee from those communities.
Hey, thanks, Kyle. I think that if we could have those seats filled by the end of March, and then shoot for a meeting April 10th. So, I think that's a reasonable time frame.
I'm writing that down now. That sounds great. You're my first meeting scheduled for April so far.
Okay, so we'll go back on the agenda. Is there any other fishery or wildlife business that we need to discuss?
This is Mike here. Isn't there, I think there's a meeting coming up too in Anchorage on Monday, with the subsistence division. Anybody hear anything about that? The subsistence department?
This is Kyle Campbell, the board support. So I believe it's the Federal Subsistence Board that is meeting in Anchorage beginning, is it Monday? I think it begins on the 31st, so on Tuesday.
Yeah, and this is Jim.
Oh, okay.
What Kyle said, the public meeting starts at 1:30 in the afternoon on the 31st, which I think is Tuesday, but in the morning, beginning at 9, I believe, on the 31st, is tribal consultations as well as formal consultations with Alaska Native corporations and Alaska Native organizations, which will be from 9 a.m. until the public meeting starts at 1:30 at the Egan Center. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Red Update.
So if there's no other questions or concerns, I'd like to make a motion to end this meeting.
I'll second that, Jim.
Well, thank you, Walter, for doing an excellent job. Maybe we lost Walter. He's off the call. Well, I'll still say it. Well, the recording is gone. Thank you to Walter and all of the members who called in today. I'm really happy to see this advisory committee kind of getting active again. And if there's anything I can do to help assist your advisory committee moving forward, please let me know.
And thank you, Kyle, you and the department. Bye.
All right. Well, have a great night, everyone, and have a good weekend. Stay warm out there.
Yeah, thanks, Kyle. Thanks, everybody. It's good to hear everybody online again.
Thanks, everyone.
Yep, everybody, good night.
Thanks, Kyle.
Happy weekend.
Happy weekend.